You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Palestine Remembered. This is an interview I did with Radio Islam out of South Africa, some wonderful sisters there. Hope you enjoy it and make sure you get along to the rally tomorrow.
We say welcome to Brother Nasser Mashni, who is Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the Insta.
Wa alaikum salam, sister. Thank you so very much for having me and for all of your efforts. May Allah reward you.
What was your reaction to Australia's decision to bar Simcha Rothman from entering the country?
Look, we welcome that decision. It's very important that we treat Israel like the pariah state it is. Whilst this barring of this far-right extremist is welcome, it's so far from what we need to be doing. You're a South African woman. You know very much the fight against apartheid in South Africa was a global movement, and Australia, New Zealand took a leadership role in that in the 80s and the 70s, and Australia should be doing much more today. So barring a far-right leader who's called Palestinian children terrorists, it is welcome and it's important. But we need to be doing so much more than that. And one of the things that is particularly disturbing for Australians like myself is to know that we continue to have two-way military trade. We continue to export and import, you know, equipment that Israel has battle-tested on Palestinians. So we need much, much more. This is a good very first step. You know, if we're trying to run a marathon, this is like a two-year-old's first step. We're a long way away, and so much more needs to be done.
Now, for our listeners who may not follow Israeli politics all that much, who exactly is Rothman and why was his planned tour so concerning?
Look, he's a junior member of the Knesset. He's part of a very extreme section of the Israeli parliament. And when I say a very extreme section of the Israeli parliament, there's 120 elected officials in the Israeli Knesset. There would be less than a dozen that we wouldn't call extreme. The difference between this guy and, you know, his colleagues like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir is they say the quiet bit out loud. And the quiet bit out loud is there's no such thing as a Palestinian. The Palestinians, you know, aren't human, that a pregnant woman has snakes inside her belly. Yeah. The really terrible, despicable language that part of the brilliant South African case of genocide. You know, one of the challenges with genocide is establishing intent. And what your colleagues and your countrymen and women were able to do was to just scrape the parliamentary records of all of these elected officials. And this is something that's very important. You know, increasingly in the West, we are talking about Benjamin Netanyahu's government, not Israelis and not Zionism, as if this horror is confined to one bad egg, that Benjamin Netanyahu is the bad egg, as opposed to the system that oppresses us, as if F.W. de Klerk was the issue, not apartheid was the issue. And this guy says the quiet bit out loud. And some people, I mean, certainly we made representations to the government, but I think we might have been just a little bit late to the party to take any real credit for the government's decision. But, you know, sent some letters in, the Minister for Home Affairs, Tony Burke, who was very unequivocal in saying that this man doesn't belong here. I think strategically the organization that was sponsoring him to come here, it's also a very extreme Zionist organization that has very challenging and problematic positions on indigenous rights in this country, in this settler colony. And it's true to form that they would try and bring a like this to this country to really inflame the situation and create more division. So, look, we applaud the Australian government on this decision, but we need so much more.
So Rothman, as you've mentioned, has openly called Gaza's children enemies. What does this tell us about the religious Zionism party and the rise of far-right politics in Israel and in Australia?
Look, it's very scary. As Palestinians, we've always known what Zionism truly was. That Zionism was the ultimate manifestation of white supremacy. And if you look at the very foundations of the Israeli state as a Zionist state, when the quote-unquote Arab Jews came to Israel, the Yemenis, mm-hmm. the Iraqis, etc., those babies were taken away from young families and they were told that, you know, their children had died in birth, couldn't see them, and they couldn't be told where they were buried. But these brown children were given to white families who'd come from Europe because they wanted to Europeanize Israel. They didn't want it to be Arab, where, in fact, for thousands of years, Jews have lived in the Arab world amongst us, Muslims, Christians, and Jews. But Israel wanted to be white. Zionism is white supremacy manifest. And so if you foundationally take children off your brethren, off your sisters, because the color of your skin is not Western European, not Polish, German, Lithuanian, etc., but Iraqi or Syrian, or in fact Palestinian, because you want to Europeanize those children, there's a challenge. And if you do that for 7 or 8 decades in some sort of insular space, and everything you believe becomes fundamentally messianic, layer into that unfettered power, support by the West, by the United States, the entire global North, that they could do no wrong, and it didn't matter what horror they committed, whether it was in 56 or 67 or 73, 82, all of the genocides and massacres that happened. This is the eventuality. Compounding superiority complex creates this sort of fascism. And one thing, another thing I forgot to mention about this white supremacy, when the Ethiopian Jews, black Jews, came to Israel, state went and quote unquote saved them from Ethiopia. For the best part of a decade, Israeli doctors were injecting the Ethiopian women with birth control, unbeknownst to the women, because they didn't want black Jews. It was bad enough that we've got brown Jews. We don't want black Jews. We want only white Jews. And this is not conjecture, not something Nasser has made up. This is fact. This is fact. Mm. Such is the racism and the white supremacy in Israel, in Zionism, that their own co-religionists, they were endeavoring to purify the country, have less browns and blacks. Because within Israel, we talk about the status and the hierarchies, as you no doubt, I'm not sure how old you are, Nisa, but there were grades of colors. Yeah.
Yes.
Obviously, everybody wanted to be white because that got you all the benefits. But then all the way down to perhaps, the people who lived in Soweto, etc. In Israel, the status is, European Jew that is white, white European Jew, and then the brown European Jew, and then the Arab Jew, and then the dark Arab Jew, and then the black Arab Jew, and then there's Druze, and then there's the Bedouins, and then there's Baha'is are in there somewhere, and then there is the Arab citizen of the State of Israel, the Palestinian. He's sixth class, she's sixth class, just within, quote-unquote, the democracy that is Israel. Mm-hmm. That's a shameful, shameful, disgusting ideology and a shameful and disgusting society that has bred this sort of supremacy. Now, 680 days, we've seen protests here and there on the weekend, some really significant protests closing the main freeway. And these people were not saying stop the genocide.
Yes.
They were not saying feed starving children. Mm-hmm. They were not saying release thousands of prisoners in Israeli gulags, stop settlement expansions, create equal rights for Palestinians. They were saying, stop the war, just get our hostages back. Mm-hmm. Not rebuild Gaza, not about humanity. There are people that live less than an hour away from Gaza. They live next to supermarkets that are fully stocked with everything that anybody could need and want. If nothing else, baby formula. Get your car filled with baby formula and drive into Gaza if you care about a shared humanity. After the Holocaust, we said never again. And never again was for everybody, not just for Jews.
How harmful is it when rhetoric like this is exported to countries like Australia under the guise of solidarity tours?
I'm grateful that the Australian government saw what the potential disaster and the potential division this guy would have sowed. I'm really concerned that we have an entity in Australia that feels that this man's views should be heard here. And this is an entity, the Australian Jewish Association, that has the largest online presence in Australia of any of the Zionist Israel lobbies, whether it be on Twitter, etc. And that's really troubling because, there's 100,000+ Australian Jewish people. Many of them are anti-Zionist, but the majority are actually Zionist. And I would be very, very, very concerned if there was a large percentage of Australian Jews that subscribed to this man's views, that subscribed to the Australian Jewish Association's views, because this guy is nothing short of a fascist. How you can call children enemies, and we have to extol the virtues of ethnically cleansing the entirety of Gaza, and some really, really problematic stuff.
Events like this also reflect tensions within the diaspora communities in Australia or any other country for that matter where someone like him may have visited, and particularly between Jewish, Palestinian, and Muslim groups. How did this actually, how did you see this responses from these groups when his visit was announced?
Look, it was a very low-key announcement. So I heard about it from one of our activists in South Australia. She sent it to me on Saturday. On Sunday, we composed a letter, sent it through in very early Monday morning, and his visa was cancelled early afternoon. As I said to you, I'm not sure that we can claim all of the credit, some of the credit, none of the credit. I think some other people have been working on it in the days before the weekend. The fact that there are a number of different groups that had identified this, had seen what was, as I understand it, just one post on Twitter, X, is a testament to the movement in Australia to be anti-fascist, to be anti-racist, and to endeavour to hold those people to account that are trying to promulgate these troubling views. We can't have that sort of stuff coming around. Australia is one of the most successful multicultural countries on earth. There is, people from more than 150 countries call Australia home. It's a new country. There's a large diversity of religions and colors and cultures and foods and peoples. And the only way that works is if we are all afforded a dignity. What has happened since October 7 is, as you may well know, the Australian Jewish community is a very well-established community in the global north, in particular in countries like Australia. They are, foundational in many of our professions, the law, in medicine, etc., and have been exemplary Australians. Now, as an Australian, how you celebrate God is an individual thing, and everybody should have the right to celebrate their God in any way they want. Of course, the caveat being that they don't use that worship to harm or hurt others. So Australian Jews have a long history and a great history in service to the country and in many different professions. Now, an Australian Jew who is very proudly Zionist, they remain an Australian and they remain have the right to practice their religion.
This is a political ideology that increasingly we should be demanding isn't given civil space
to participate in civil discourse. One of the challenges we face that Israel has prosecuted and had great success, particularly in the global north, is to create a conflation between Israel, geography, bit of land, Zionism, a political ideology, and Judaism, a religion, to create what I call an unholy trinity. An unholy trinity. Christians, they believe in the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, a unity. They call that the Holy Trinity. The unholy trinity is the conflation of Israel, which is land, Zionism, political ideology, and Judaism, a religion. And as Muslims, we believe that Jews are people of the book. They are our cousins. That this political ideology is a disgusting political ideology that's predicated on the dispossession, the oppression, the murder of Palestinians. The notion of Zionism as a Jewish homeland esoterically sounds okay. The challenge is when it's manifested, what it means is they, bulldozed my grandparents' house, killed my grandfather, threw my father out of his house. He ended up in one country, my uncles ended up in another country. The very next day, they harvested my grandfather's fields and they said they built a country. Well, then, you didn't build a country. The next day, they milked our cows, they herded the goats, they took the eggs from under the chickens. In Arabic, we say, Akhaduha mafrushi. They took it furnished. They took Palestine furnished. They didn't build a country. And so, Zionism, as it's manifested itself as a Palestinian, equals dispossession, equals Holocaust, equals genocide, equals oppression. And if it wasn't enough that they took our land and killed our people, etc., they continue to do it, as we've seen evidence in the past 22 months now in Gaza. The challenge we have with social cohesion in Australia is that Zionism, the State of Israel, since October 7 has, been afforded a space that, should not exist for it, should not exist for it. We were very clear and very articulate that anybody that supported apartheid in the 70s had no place here. And I'm sure this won't be something that your listeners haven't heard before, sister, but I've met a lot of South Africans, many of them left in the late 90s, and every one of them, you'll be surprised to hear, was against apartheid. I said, out of my conversation with them is, if you're against apartheid, why didn't you leave whilst Nelson Mandela was in jail? If you left in the 70s or 80s, I'd believe you. But if you left in 99, you weren't against apartheid. It just took you longer to sell your business than the other guy.
All right, that's quite candid, but I'm sure many people will disagree with you on that because their feelings about it. I think many still feel that it's apartheid in reverse in South Africa. I think that's a topic for another time.
Is there any coloured people that think it's apartheid in reverse, or is it only white people?
I think it would be white people. I can say that as a person of mixed race. Yeah, definitely. I'm considered colored in this country, coming from the original people of the original African people of the soil, as we are known, the Khoi people.
Yeah, we don't have the chance to go into a time machine, like very quickly. I think, one of the best things, the humanity and dignity of the late great Nelson Mandela and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the challenge perhaps was that after that there was no compensation, no restitution, no reparations. After we hugged it all out, quote unquote, the white guy still owned the farm. And that economic disparity in power, means educational outcomes are different, et cetera, housing rights. I wish we had a time machine, we would fix up a lot of things.
3CR. Hi, this is Rafif Ziada, and you're listening to 3CR, pro-Palestinian, happily proud radio.
Going back to the topic, could Australia be compared to historical international solidarity movements such as the global anti-apartheid campaign? And what lessons can we learn from that?
It's certainly been our contention at the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network that Australia took a leadership role with New Zealand, Aotearoa, in the 70s. We banned cricket tours and the Springboks weren't allowed to tour. And, ultimately, as a middle power, and then I don't even think we were a middle power then, we're a smaller country. We were very, very active in ensuring the isolation of apartheid South Africa that ultimately saw, second last the United Kingdom and last the United States to sanction it. And that economic boycotts and divestment and sanctions meant that it became isolated and had to change. Now, Australia can do the same. Unfortunately, we haven't had the political courage or the political will to enact that. I'm hopeful, still remain hopeful. And that was certainly evidenced a couple of weeks ago when in excess of 300,000 people marched across the iconic Sydney Harbour Bridge to say to our Prime Minister, enough, we want you to do more. And it wasn't long after that that Australia made the announcement that we would be recognising Palestine. Again, as I said, if we're trying to run a marathon, it's like a two-year-old crawling. It's a long way away from what we need to be doing. What we need to be doing, and this is particularly the boycott, divestments and sanctions movement that has been mirrored on the South African, the successful South African struggle for against apartheid, is that in South Africa, it was a country that had its own natural resources. So it was able to withstand the global boycott for a little bit longer. Whereas Israel is an importer. Israel is an importer of food, etc., energy, etc. It actually needs the world far more than South Africa did in the 70s and 80s.
Yes.
And in fact, the system would collapse in less than a year in Israel because it's entirely dependent on export for revenue because it has very little natural resources. Those exports are military, significantly military, as well as diamonds, of course, blood diamonds from Africa. And that once it's blacklisted, that economy will collapse in less than 12 months. So the job can happen, and it can happen quickly, and we can have dignity, humanity, and equality in the Holy Land if we do enact these policies. And it behooves the Australian government to be on the right side of history. I mean, there's 147 countries that recognise Palestine. By the time we get to the United Nations, I guess we'll be number 151 or maybe 160. We don't have to be the last country to sanction Israel. You know, we can be amongst the first.
So how do you see Australia's decision fitting into a broader trend of countries holding foreign politicians accountable for hate speech and incitement?
I don't know that it's that exceptional a position. I imagine this guy could get to the United States without too much trouble. I imagine he'd get to the United Kingdom without too much trouble. Australia is a faraway place, very small population. I'd like to think that our country was way better and would hold all of these sorts of hate preachers to the same account. Yeah, look, I'm not sure that there's too much we can draw from it, Anissa. I'm not sure there's too much we can draw from it.
Yeah.
That said, it's quote unquote a win and we will bank the win.
Now, Amnesty International has accused Israel of carrying out a deliberate campaign of starvation. I think more than Amnesty International, there are many other aid groups out there for what we're seeing in Gaza at the moment. In this light, what does barring a figure like Rothman mean for the global push for accountability?
You're right. I mean, when you put it like that, it's not just Amnesty International. It's something like 100 different aid groups are saying that this is a war crime. It's the United Nations. It's the Secretary General of the United Nations has said so. UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese has said so. Many, many human rights, Médecins Sans Frontières, et cetera, et cetera. The list is over 100. And when you put that scale, the scale of this atrocity, the scale of the anguish in the pictures we see live on our phones from citizen journalists in Gaza sharing, and us sharing it on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and TikTok, to see the pain in a mother's eyes holding her emaciated child, knowing that every day the chances of this woman getting enough nourishment to be able to lactate, to be able to feed her newborn, how harrowing those images are. The knowledge, you know, starving to death takes months. It doesn't just happen. And for many children, this will irrevocably stunt their development mentally and physically. Mm-hmm. You know, the impacts of this is going to be generational. Like, they will be stunted and challenged brain developments, etc. And their offspring will also be, and so on. It'll take generations to clean this out. But when you put the magnitude of that horror together, and then you say they banned one junior member of parliament, it puts into scale just how small this action was. What needs to be happening is countries like Australia, global north, fully developed countries, with capacity and ability, should be sending the hospital ship at the very least to break the siege, should be sending a military force to protect Palestinians and to hold Israel to account, should be cancelling all contracts with, should be demanding our banks don't invest in their stock market products, that, you know, the full range of diplomatic tools that are available to us that we have seen applied to Russia in their war against Ukraine, that we've seen the hypocrisy and duplicity of the victims that are white and the victims that are brown, victims that are Christian, victims that are majority Muslim, that we see that hypocrisy laid out for the global South. And when you measure the scale of the horror versus the actual action, again, that same analogy, we're trying to run a marathon and it's a 2-year-old taking their first steps.
And then finally, from an advocacy perspective, how can APAN and other groups leverage this moment to strengthen awareness and support for Palestine and also, you know, for democratic societies worldwide?
So I think, I'll talk in the global north, you know, somebody who's lived their entire life in Australia, we've had very solid support for our movement for Palestinian rights for decades. And when I say solid support, I'd say, you know, something like 5% of the population. And I think Zionists and, you know, Jewish supremacy in the Holy Land, it's probably only had about the same amount of support, 5%. And 5% for them and 5% for us leaves 90% of the population in the middle, yeah? But because we are brown, and because Australia is intrinsically, you know, foundationally from colonization, institutionally racist, because we are brown, we're mostly Muslim, that 90% of people were not necessarily all supporters of Israel, but some of them would have been, you know, whether it was Christian Zionism, whether it's white supremacy, whether it's business reasons or whatever. But a big chunk of that 90% hovered in proximity to Israel, hovered over there in proximity, because, well, they didn't want to hover near us because we're Muslims and brown and September 11 and jihadis and all of the negative stereotyping that Hollywood has pushed out for 100 years. Yeah. All of the Orientalism of Edward Said's magnificent book. And so everything we said about Zionism being white supremacy and settler colonialism and racism and fascism manifest. On October 6th, nobody believed us, sister. Nobody believed us. And on October 7th, October 8th in the West, in the global North, with all of the lies that Israel exported, all of the lies that have since been disproved, all of the lies that nobody's apologized for. No mainstream newspaper in the world has said, sorry, we should never have published this lie without verifying 40 beheaded babies, babies in the oven, a woman's womb being cut open and a baby pulled out, a woman's breast being cut off and used for a football, systematic rapes. All of those lies that were rolled out in the days and weeks after October 7 manufactured the consent for the horror that we see in front of us. And that by the time those lies were exposed, again, nobody apologized, the damage had been done in the psyche of the global north. And so Israel defending itself has a right to defend itself. What other bombs and guns do you need? And so in those first 3 months of the genocide, late 23, everybody went to Israel. Rishi Sunak, Macron, Johnson, even one of our former prime ministers, Scott Morrison, went. Biden went, America sent a nuclear submarine and ships to the region, all for a tiny country. That those people that were adjacent to Israel, those 90 people, probably got a little bit closer. Now, self-defense, in a kindergarten sense, four-year-old, you took my toy, I took your toy, you threw sand on me, I threw sand on you. Self-defense is pretty self-explanatory for most people. And there's a point, though, where most people go, hold on, this is not self-defense. Now, whether that was in November of 23, December of 23, February of 24, April of 24, December of 24, February of 20, nobody today, except for members of the Ku Klux Klan and your white apartheid Knicks that are dreaming for the old days in South Africa, and maybe some of Donald Trump's MAGA crew, are actually going, this is self-defense. Everyone else, other than rabid fascists and Zionists, can see this as Old Testament hate and genocide. And so those people that sat, those 90 people that sat close to the Zionists have been dislocated because they don't want to be associated with that. So they've been dislocated from there. Some of them might still be close to that because they're such Islamophobes that they still have sat close to that that space. But most of those 90, and I'd say probably 80, have dislocated from proximity to Israel. A big chunk of them have moved towards us. That's evidenced by the 300,000 plus that were in Sydney across the Harbour Bridge. And then there's a whole bunch that are never, ever going to be on Israel's side. And never, ever going to believe that Israel is the land of milk and honey and it's a democracy and all the lies that Israel has sold. And it's our job as a movement for justice for Palestine globally to seize the opportunity to bring those people to our side and to explain to them that the fight for Palestine is a fight for liberation and justice for all. That in the words of Nelson Mandela, none of us is free until Palestine is free.
Brother Nasser Mishni, shukran for joining us today on The Insight and for sharing your perspective on this very important development.
Thank you so much for your work, Anissa, and all of your colleagues, and may God reward you all.
And that was my interview with Anissa Isaak from Radio Islam International in South Africa. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you share the podcast and tell your friends. And very importantly, get along tomorrow. Tell all your friends all over the continent to get to their local rally details at the APAN website, apan.org.au, apan.org.au. Let's make sure that tomorrow's huge. Thanks for listening. Share the podcast. Tell your friends. And remember, there's never been a better time for a free Palestine.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.